You're listening to Grace Saves All, the podcast which exists at the spiritual intersection of Christianity and universal salvation. In this podcast, we will be exploring an ancient and modern approach to Christianity, which affirms both that grace saves alone and that grace goes to all. And now, here is David Artman, author of Grace Saves All, The Necessity of Christian Universalism.
Today, I welcome back to the Grace Saves All podcast, Brian McLaren. Hello, Brian.
Great to be back with you.
And I also want to welcome my good friend and ministerial colleague and guest co-host for today's episode, Don Morrow. Hello, Don.
Hey, David. Thanks for asking me to join you.
Don is the minister of First Christian Church in Bentonville, Arkansas since 1997 and led the establishment of Waterway in September 2005. Don, can you tell us a little more about your ministry setting and maybe how you became aware and appreciative of Brian's work?
Sure. I'm in Bentonville, Arkansas, far northwest corner of Arkansas, home of a little family retail organization called Walmart. And I've been here for 27 plus years in Bentonville. I became aware of Brian's work actually at a national pastors convention, the very first one, I think, which I don't know for sure that it was the first one, but I think it was 2001.
Man, that's a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. And I will confess that when I went, I had never heard of Brian McLaren at that point. It was a largely, most of the pastors there were evangelical. I was in this mainline setting, a Disciples of Christ church, was trying to kind of marry my theology with some practices that had a little more energy than what my mainline experience had been, and read about this in, I think, Christianity Today. Brian, was that one of the sponsors of that event? Do you remember? Leadership Magazine? I can't remember. Anyway.
Yeah.
And that's right. And Brennan Manning and Rick Warren, I think, were both kind of speakers that I had read. And there happened to be a day, I think it was the second day, there was a time for group breakouts and small sessions. And I had nothing that really spoke to me or people that I was there to see. And there was one, I think it was called What is Postmodernism, or something like that. And I had just kind of started hearing that term and really didn't know what it was. And some guy named Brian McLaren was leading it. And I went, and seriously, I'm not just saying this because you're on here. I've been a huge fan since about 10 minutes into that conversation. And I can still tell you what that beginning of the conversation was. You ask this room full of pastors, you know, what are the things that that your church gets most consumed by or fights over? And we made this list up on the whiteboard of, you know, the colors of the carpet and all of the big church things we fight about. And then there was, okay, now what are the things that most people in the world are concerned about? And we made a list of 10 things, and there was zero overlap. And I was just like, yeah, that's why we are where we are. And anyway, so I've appreciated your work since 2001 and have read, I think, pretty much everything you've published. So appreciate the opportunity to be in conversation.
Well, that's very encouraging. And I remember those great gatherings at that event. And that's so nice to know that rang true. That's great.
Well, Brian, the reason I wanted to invite Don to share in this conversation is today is that back in 2011 or 12, we both went for a meeting of ministers in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, where you were the keynote speaker, and both Don and I have appreciated your work over the years. And Brian, you've interacted with lots of different kinds of Christian groups and denomination. I wonder, what is your general impression of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ?
Well, first, I think you have maybe the best name of any denomination.
The longest, anyway.
And Disciples of Christ is a very big name to live up to. But my goodness, having it in your name, it creates an aspiration that I think is great. You know, I'll tell you two things I especially respect in the disciples. One is the centrality of communion, the idea that we would be brought together by a practice more than by a creed or a set of behavioral agreements or submission to the same hierarchy. It seems to me that is a very, very beautiful and powerful thing. And the second being that you all have really empowered local churches to say, you know, we have responsibility to grow up and take responsibility for our own work. And I think those are beautiful and empowering characteristics.
Well, one of the things I like about the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, I like to say there's no limit that's put on how good God might be. And it's just understood that the ministers and the members of the church are both, we're all on a journey where there's growth and new horizons that are still possible. So we're not limited by a creed as a test of fellowship. So we can sort of identify with that generous orthodoxy and we hold our beliefs seriously, but we also hold them lightly in a way that we still want to be open with conversation. So we've enjoyed, I'll just say we in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ have enjoyed having you as a conversation partner and interlocutor and inspirational speaker for many years now. So I want to thank you for that as we get started.
And I should tell you both, I have several friends who came from different backgrounds and reached a point where whatever their existing connections weren't working. And I recommended they go to the Disciples, and the Disciples has been a good home for those friends. So I'm super grateful for your role.
All right. Well, today, what we're going to do is Don and I will take turns asking you questions and visiting, kind of like in one of those conference after session moments where those of us who've done church ministry get to kind of casually hang out and visit with a keynote speaker and process the moment that we are in. And Don and I have not coordinated our questions in advance, so there may be a little repetition or crossover along the way. So, Brian, if I can appropriate the title of one of your many books, are you ready to make the road by walking?
Let's go.
Okay, so I'll begin the conversation with the question, why do so many Christians, particularly in the American context, either fail to see fascism or even worse, seem to see it pretty clearly and just like it? And this problem is not just about the evangelical church, which went in for about 85% for Trump last time, almost 60%. Of the supposedly more moderate mainline Protestants voted for him as well. So, Brian, how can we learn to see fascism or authoritarianism so we don't get taken in by it?
Ooh, man, David, what a question. I mean, this is, let's jump right in the deep end. This is important. Gosh. Yeah, you know, when I started studying authoritarianism, fascism, in earnest, it was in early 2016 when I was watching, you know, the election that was happening that year. And in January of that year, there were still, I forget how many candidates, but a whole lot of candidates. And I watched them all stand up vigorously against Trump. And then as soon as they lost, they came and bowed the knee to him. And I remember thinking, he was much more vicious in his insults of them. And yet they're completely sacrificing their pride and sort of humility. It wasn't just humbling themselves. They were humiliating themselves in deference to him. And I had a couple of friends who were psychologists, one a sociologist. And I said, and actually there were a couple others as well, communication specialist, and I just said, hey, will you send me any articles that will help me understand what's happening in our politics right now that you think are peer-reviewed, empirically based, or theoretically sound? And so they just started sending me articles. And so that became my first kind of education in this subject. And then in 2017, I think most people will remember, there was a big rally in Charlottesville, Virginia by a group called Unite the Right, which was a combination of white supremacists, some overtly neo-Nazi, and other kind of fringe but well-armed groups who showed up in Charlottesville. I was asked to be part of the clergy presence and counter-protest. So, and I haven't figured out the math of how old I was, but I guess I'm 69 now, so I was about 63 at that time, or 62. And I never thought in my 62 years of life then that I would see people carrying Nazi flags, swastikas, marching down the street of an American city, chanting Nazi slogans, carrying torches, of course, at night, carrying baseball bats as if they were looking for a fight. And I was just 100 yards away or so when a young woman, Heather Hayer, was murdered by an automobile, a guy driving an automobile to drive right through a crowd and hurt and potentially kill as many people as he could. And I just thought, after that weekend, I thought, this is really happening. You know, this is something I never expected. And so that even doubled down my research on the subject. And if I could give two statements in general, and then we can take it from there. The first is, this is one of the greatest failures of the Christian religion, that a couple of generations after the Nazis in Germany, the Christian church has not decided to teach its people how to discern a fascist, an authoritarian, a dictator in the making. It's just stunning failure that after this happened in Germany, a predominantly Christian nation, combination of primarily Catholic and Lutheran, but many other kinds of Christians too, that the church in America didn't say, we better prepare people that, because this could happen again. We better make sure people have the discernment to know how to pick a good leader, especially because there's an awful lot in the Bible about bad leaders and good leaders. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, I suspect there's a body of research we could talk about something called the authoritarian personality. And I could suggest one reason why we haven't done that important work of teaching people about the dangers of authoritarianism is that many churches are led by authoritarian pastors, and they've attracted people who would like an authoritarian leader. And these pastors actually become aggregators that they can then deliver authoritarian followers to the right authoritarian leader when he comes along. So those would be a couple of things I'd say in response to your question.
And Don, you want to chime in on that?
Sure. I think one of the things that I've been reflecting on a lot in this moment is the rise in Christian nationalism in the country that I feel as yes. though has kind of paved the way for the Christian buy-in and maybe blindness yeah. to the rise in fascism. And I just wonder if you see the connections there. And I also mm-hmm. am curious, in looking back, where you might now see through eyes of wisdom and hindsight, where the church at large, and again, not just in the evangelical world, but I grew up in a church with a Christian flag and a US flag on the yeah. on the podium, on the stage. And I think all of those things in small steps contributed to yes. some of what we're experiencing now.
Yeah, that's a great question, Don. I first of all, one of the things that has happened that's very sad, this happens in a lot of countries. It's sad that it happens in America because America proclaims being exceptional, which I think means a cut above the rest. I think we're as bad or worse than most of the rest in our teaching of history to our children. Mm-hmm. Just as an example, a few months ago, I was on a long drive and I listened to a book on tape, or recorded book, audio book, by Rachel Maddow called Prequel. And she told the story in that book of support in the United States for the Nazis and for Hitler mm-hmm. In the 1930s, right up until Pearl Harbor. And it was a stunning story. And I thought, I'm a well-educated person. I never heard this information before. Why was this information kept from me? And then I found out, you know, and then I sort of looked back on earlier parts of our history and realized we have been taught a sanitized version of our history, I think, to save ourselves from shame. And of course, right. I live in the state of Florida, where we have a governor who's very outspoken in shutting down anything that would make white, especially rich white people, feel bad about our history. Listen, if we don't face, this is one of the things I love about the Bible. The Bible tells the horrible things that King David did. The Bible tells the idolatries that the people of Israel kept falling into. The Gospels do not present the disciples as heroes. The disciples seem like bumbling buffoons. It's almost like a comedy show sometimes. Their get-it factor is so low. The Bible is honest about history. It doesn't sanitize Peter's denial of Jesus, right? It doesn't sanitize the big argument between Paul and Peter, or between Paul and Barnabas in the book of Acts. The Bible is so honest, and we're so dishonest. Mm-hmm. So that sets us up to not learn from our history. And if I could add one thing to it that then makes a connection to Christian nationalism, you know, any nation that started through stealing the lands of indigenous people and attempting genocide. I mean, and that this wasn't 300 years ago. This was 110 years ago. When I was researching my book, Do I Stay Christian? And again, when I was researching Life After Doom, I read again about how in the early 20th century, people were sent out, and the late 19th, early 20th century, people were sent out with guns to shoot as many bison as they could in the American West to hamstring Native Americans because they had their lives were dependent on bison. And they slaughtered as many bison as they could just to take away any viable future for Native Americans. Look, a nation that has that attempted genocide in its history has a deep authoritarian past. And then a nation that enslaves people for hundreds of years, and much of the shape of the U.S. Constitution was to pacify Southerners to let them keep their slaves. We've got authoritarianism deep in our roots, and if when I want to talk to my grandchildren about what it means to be an American, I love this country. It's a beautiful country, so many wonderful, beautiful people. But here's the way I say it to my grandkids. You have to remember there have always been two Americas, a beautiful America of kind people who want to do what's right, and an ugly America that's so desperate for money, they will enslave people, they'll steal their lands, they'll become racists. And so I think we have to help people see this. That strand of authoritarianism always uses religion, that ugly strand of authoritarianism, always uses whatever form of religion is available to help give it moral cover and moral camouflage. So when I hear the word Christian nationalism, what I actually hear is America's hallowed tradition of authoritarianism in its current form, always using religion to justify what it's doing.
Well, Ryan, my birthday just happens to be April the 20th, and if your birthday is April the 20th, you sooner or later find out that you share a birthday with Adolf Hitler. Mm. My last name, Artman, is German, so I've always kind of wondered what I would have done if I would have been in the Weimar Republic during his time. And so many people were swept up in that, it's kind of hard to believe that I would be exceptional, but so I guess I'll never know. But so I thought that, I guess in the back of my mind, I've always thought that if fascism ever came to my door, that I would not be like Martin Niemöller, the German pastor that said, you know, first they came for the socialists and then I didn't say anything, and the communists and down and the Jews. And then finally they came for me and there was nobody left to speak for me. And then I had a couple of times now been through taking youth groups through the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And man, you know, you go through that and then there's that reflection time at the end. And I just, you know, if this ever came to my door, I would not be silent. I would, you know, I would speak out about the horrors of where this can lead. So I really think that we are kind of in that moment right now where it might not seem to everybody, well, Trump got elected and, you know, so can it really be fascism? Can it really be that? Can it really be that bad? But my sense is that there is enough of the rhetoric, enough of the action, enough of the violence that's already happened. One of the great scholars of fascism, Robert Paxton, has said that Trump now qualifies especially since the January 6th insurrection. Other scholars of note, like Jason Stanley, has written the book How Fascism Works. You know that there is enough that has happened for us to be able to say that we should say, yes, this is a moment. Fascism is not a theoretical thing. It is here, and it's really here. It's really an issue that we have to call out, and it's up to, you know, basically everybody that has any professional responsibility to say at this point that we see it and to start warning people about it, that it's here and it's time to know what it is and to do whatever you can in whatever situation that you're in to speak out against it. So I was wondering if you could say something about that.
Yes. So, first, I wonder if I could share just something that I just came across recently. Matthew Fox included this quote in his Daily Meditations. It's a quote from Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. And I won't read the whole thing. It's three paragraphs long. But let me just read a couple of sentences. This tells us that what we're calling authoritarianism, it's a part of human history, right? It's not something new. It's a major part of human history. And the fact that we've been part of a democracy that for 200 years has tried to resist tyranny, over 200 years has tried to resist tyranny, tells us that we're almost an anomaly in the world, right? And if we're not careful, we'll lose that special status. But here's a quote from St. Thomas Aquinas, the great Catholic theologian. The disregard of the common good is greater under an oligarchy than a democracy. But worst of all is a tyranny where the advantage of one man is sought. The rule of a tyrant is worst. Security is banished. Everything's uncertain when people are cut off from the law and depend on the will, I would even say the greed of another. The tyrant oppresses the bodies of his subject, but what is more damnable, he threatens their spiritual growth, for he is set in his own power, not their progress. He is suspicious of any dignity that they may possess that will prejudice his own iniquitous domination. A tyrant is more fearful of a good person than of a bad person, for he dreads their strange virtue. And that phrase, strange virtue, arrested me when I first read it. I was thinking of Trump's hatred for John McCain. And why did he hate John McCain? Well, John McCain was a war hero. He was a courageous man who stood up under difficulty and suffered torture. I think Trump and his kind don't understand that kind of virtue. I think about a couple of, in recent weeks, when a few world leaders have been in the White House and our president and vice president insulted them. And I thought, they don't like the dignity of other people because it's something that exposes their lack of character and their lack of dignity. They don't like this. They have to insult the strange virtue of others. And I think we've all met individuals who have this characteristic. Something is broken in them. And I don't hate them. I have compassion for them. I think, what happened to you that you would turn out this way, you know? And yet here it is. And it's nothing new in human history, but somehow we have not seen it. And I hope one of the things that happens through whatever the outcome of this current situation is, I hope we will, especially our responsible, ethical faith communities will say, we'd better help people understand what Thomas Aquinas knew in the 1200s, right? The other thing I would say is that the way fascism works, it's like a script that is so predictable. It's so boring, and yet it works again and again. It's a, like a lot of other, authoritarianism is related to con artistry, and the same con artistry tricks seem to work again and again and again. People get sucked into them. I just a couple of months ago got sucked in by a con artist, and it's relevant to our conversation here. I got an email from somebody I know, and the email said, "Hi, Brian, I'd love to have you back on my podcast. I'm going to do Facebook Live, and I have one of my assistants will be in touch with you if we can agree on a date to get a date and to get you set up to do a Facebook Live." Well, guess what? It wasn't my friend. Somebody had commandeered her website and her email address and was pretending to be her. And in so doing, they got into my Facebook account as they set me up for a Facebook Live. I totally was taken in, right? So con artists are good at what they do, and authoritarianism has some time-tested tricks. All the more reason we should be aware of them.
Don, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I just think building on that, that, you know, it's the con artist certainly rings true with the current moment that we're in. And, and I thought that folks I never thought that Trump would get elected the first time around, because it was clear that he is a con artist, and the lies that he tells seem so clear on the one hand, but they get repeated so often that people stop questioning them. And and it reminded me actually of something, I think it was Gareth Higgins that I heard talk about, how much stories shape us. I think this was in your Learning How to See, one of the seasons. And the stories shape us whether they're true or not. What I remember at least taking away from that conversation that I really appreciated was that our positive stories can shape us whether they're true or not as well. And well, I think one of the things that I keep hearing from people in my congregation is, by and large, the folks in my congregation see what's happening as a massive problem, and it's a scary problem. The question is always, what do we do? And and most people don't have a good sense of what we can do, including me at times. I do think that living into those positive narratives, the kingdom or kingdom of God kinds of narratives, is one of the, sometimes it feels like the only thing we can do, even though it feels powerless. I think it's the only power we have in some respect.
You know, and as you said earlier, David, many of our denominations, 85% and more of people supported and still support the president. And even in our more liberal or mainline denominations, I think there are only two denominations that in 2024 did not have a majority that voted for Trump, two Christian denominations, the UCC and the Episcopal Church. Every other denomination that I'm aware of had 51% or more who voted for him. So this makes it difficult for pastors to talk about this, because then people say, oh, you're being political. But I think what you just said, Don, is the way we talk about this. We talk about the kingdom of God and what it stands for. And when we talk about what Jesus and his message was all about, it makes very, very clear that certain things the kingdom of God is about. And the thing we have to do is we have to become more explicit that the vision of Jesus for our future is very, very different than visions of contemporary philosophies and economic systems and so on for our future. And if we don't feel we have the right to proclaim that different value system, then we already have lost, you know? Would it be helpful to give my little sort of five-part definition of what authoritarianism is? Would that
sure,
be useful?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
So authoritarianism is a process of centralizing power. That's the first thing people need to know. It's a process of centralizing power in an individual, party, or cabal. A cabal is a network of different aligned groups. So authoritarianism is a way of centralizing power, and there are four techniques that authoritarians use. First is fear. Fear of an other, an enemy, a danger, a threat. This dangerous enemy other may exist or may not exist. So, for example, some years ago, there was in the first Trump administration, August of 2017 in Charlottesville, if you turned on several cable news stations, you would have thought that Antifa was this major conspiracy about to take over the government. Antifa was a few hundred people in the country who were not amassing weapons, were not planning to overthrow the government, were not planning to take over the Capitol. They were a few hundred people. And I met many of them in Charlottesville, and they were not bad people, right? But they were magnified. It's how authoritarianism works. It makes you be afraid. The governor of my state loves to talk about the woke leftist mob, right? He's talking about me, right? I don't hurt people. I don't attack people, but I'm part of the woke leftist mob. I haven't taken over any Capitol buildings or, you know, anything like that. So, fear of a real or imagined enemy. They exaggerate the enemy and make the enemy so dangerous that then people think, I need this strong man to protect me from the enemy. Second thing is division. Fear is first, then division. Division to split families, to split communities, to split churches, to split political parties, to split neighbors based on loyalty to the authoritarian leader and the authoritarian regime. Third, distortion and distraction from the truth. Authoritarians not just lie, they lie constantly because their goal is to render people, to make people feel helpless in knowing what the truth is. So then when you have no idea what the truth is because you're hearing so many lies and conspiracy theories, you can't know what the truth is for yourself, so you just outsource trust to somebody with a lot of strength. And then next, suppression of dissent. So when authoritarians come to power, they try to shut up or kick out or disappear anyone who stands against them. So if you have those five things, centralizing power through fear, through division, through distortion and distraction from the truth, suppression of dissent, you know that you're on your way to authoritarianism. And that has helped me, and it seems to cover the ground, you know, what people are facing. That's not that hard to teach people. And then you think of the opposite. Isn't it interesting that Jesus constantly says, do not fear? He's not trying to spread fear. And instead of making people afraid of the enemy, Jesus invites the enemy to dinner, right? Jesus is willing to meet with the enemy privately to have a conversation. Instead of distortion or distraction of the truth, straightforward telling of the truth, let your yes be yes, let your no be no. And instead of suppression of dissent, Jesus engages with people and invites people to ask questions. It's the very opposite of suppression of dissent. And in fact, the people who dissent against him kill him, and he doesn't threaten to kill them. He believes that truth goes with vulnerability, not with domination. So this is a message we could actually teach people. It's so clear in the Gospels. One last thing. Jesus says, one of my favorite passages, it's in two of the Gospels in a slightly different way, but Jesus says, don't be like the Gentiles. They lord it over other people. Don't be like them. We have a whole different approach to leadership than the leadership of the authoritarian regimes of the Gentiles. And Jesus got this so much.
Well, I know that one of the things that people I do ask the question, well, what can we do? Yeah. And I think one of the things that we can do is name it.
Yes.
And it's very powerful just to name it. And, so I name it as fascism. I think that's the best term for it. Fascism is a kind of authoritarianism.
Yes.
And it's very recognizable. And if you just take the time to understand what it is, then once you can name it,
yes,
and you can learn how to describe it and learn language for it. I heard one doctor I was talking with said that if you don't have language for it, if you can't name it, it just exists as a fear with inside of you.
Yes.
But once you can name something and you have language for it, then you can move it up and begin to process it and,
yes,
and think about it. So just name it and to think about it and to say that you don't agree with it, just in conversations with friends or just to begin to start talking about it. That's a very important, that's one of the things I'm trying to do on the podcast, is just give people language, try to get the conversation going. Let's talk about this. And talking about it is not nothing. Gathering together and having conversations about this is not nothing. And naming it is not nothing.
It's spreading awareness. It's spreading consciousness. It's helping people develop the discernment that should have been developed in them decades ago. It's catching up and doing really important work. And I'm so glad you're having this conversation and speaking so openly about these things. One of there's a lot of argument about the word fascism, but one of the things that I think most scholars agree on fascism is that fascism is a form of authoritarianism where the authoritarian leader works closely with industrial leaders and wealthy people.
Yes. Yeah. It's very friendly to that.
Mm-hmm. And, just add that to the equation and let people decide for themselves, right?
And another thing about fascism is hypermasculinity and the glamorization of violence. And,
yes,
you know, I have been, both Don and I have spent our time in mainline Protestantism where we've been real concerned that women and LGBTQ folks are not overly marginalized and have opportunities, and that we try to, you know, make up for the wrongs that have happened there. And I haven't spent much time really investigating what's going on the evangelical side of the fence, but I recently read Kristen Cobe Dumais' book, Jesus and John Wayne, and she chronicles how there's been this anxiety about masculinity that has now been heightened up to it's kind of an ultra-masculinity, yeah, kind of a toxic masculinity that's going on in evangelicalism that kind of leads to almost like a new kind of crusade or warrior cult.
Yes.
That's developing. And since you have a little more experience with, mm-hmm, the evangelical side of things, could you just talk about that kind of anxiety and how evangelicalism has gotten so caught up in this kind of warrior mentality?
Yes. Well, let me say that one of the ways that authoritarian works, it's paradoxical. It wants there to be an alpha male, but an alpha male is worth nothing unless he has a whole lot of beta males around. And so, ironically, these groups that are heralding masculinity, what they really are trying to produce is beta males who will submit to the alpha male, who won't question him, who will, you know, bow the knee to him. A well-known religious leader, yet another evangelical, charismatic religious leader who was leading these worship events around the country, was just, you know, kind of called out for a whole lot of money that has been misspent. And whenever anybody tried to confront him about his misbehavior, of course, he would attack them and insult them and all the rest. It's just this typical little bullying alpha male who can get away with murder if he can get enough people who he can intimidate into letting him be the strong man and they be the submissive, beta males or females or whatever. It's just such a old pattern. There is something about our theology that contributes to this. And I come from an evangelical background. I come from a fundamentalist background. So I know this from the inside. You know, the vision that many fundamentalists and evangelicals have of God is an authoritarian. God has absolute will and makes everything happen. And there are all kinds of ethical and theological problems with this, but it's deeply embedded. Even Christians in denominations that are not supposed to be Calvinist have this view of a ultimate authoritarian dictatorial God who makes everything happen and brutally tortures anyone who doesn't go along with it. And so that theology ends up justifying a certain kind of authoritarian, and because it's patriarchal, it's always an authoritarian man.
Well, Don, even though you're in a more progressive congregation, you're in the midst of kind of a sea of really strong evangelicalism. Sure. And how have you seen this hypermasculinity developing in your context?
Oh yeah, it's everywhere. You know, the same time that I was going to those national pastors conventions 20 plus years ago, all of the big men's fellowship conventions that are still happening in the Bible Belt part of the country. And I, even in our congregation, which is very progressive, we'll regularly have folks come say, "Hey, they're advertising this, you know, let's go watch these guys lift weights and spread the good news." And, you know, I'll just take a glance at it, and it just, in big red bold letters, is saying, "Oh, this is not what you want your people to be hearing." But it's so prevalent in the air we breathe, in at least in this part of the country, that even folks who are inclined to be more progressive in their thinking just assume that kind of masculinity is the natural way to be. And it is incredibly problematic and destructive. And oftentimes when I'm bold enough to have the conversation with somebody and say, "Here's why I don't think we should do that," they often at least understand where I'm coming from, even if they don't agree. But it is very rich in the Christian world, and even in our progressive community. What you're describing as the authoritarian God, a God who's in complete control of absolutely everything, that's still kind of like the foundational idea that most people have, because I think it's just so prevalent in American Christianity.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting, in the Gospels, a primary metaphor in Jesus' day for God was king. And I think Jesus systematically deconstructs that metaphor by then. He talks about the kingdom of God, but he almost never, I can't think of a time when he refers to God as king. Now, some of his parables, maybe, but the king usually doesn't behave the way a good king should, right? So Jesus emphasizes father. We might say, well, isn't that male? Yeah, but the kind of father that Jesus pictures in his parables and in his stories is a compassionate, gracious, forgiving, merciful father, the very opposite of the, you know, tough guy, type A, alpha male, dominating, get revenge, beat your kid. That's not the kind of father Jesus presents. And then Jesus uses feminine images. He says, "I feel like a mother hen who wanted to gather her chicks under her wings." You know, he says, "I'm about to go to the cross," and he says, "It's like a mother who, in labor pain, you know, has great sorrow, great pain, but her pain turns to joy." He uses childbirth as the image for what he is doing. So I think, if we really paid attention to Jesus, we would see him undermining those things. You picture him talking to Peter, and Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And then he says, Jesus says, "I'm going to go to Jerusalem and get killed." And Jesus says, "No way, man. We'll never let that happen. You're going to win. You're going to kick butt. You're not going to get hurt." And Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan," right? Okay. So there's this violent version of masculinity. Richard Rohr, my friend and colleague, often says the reason that God had to send Jesus was because the man, the model of manhood is what was causing all the trouble in the world. And so he had to send a man who would model a different kind of manhood.
Brian, I wanted to ask you about this because I've been trying to sound the alarm about, you know, fascism and say, I think fascism is really a problem and how it, you know, can be weaponized and it kind of glamorizes violence in all kinds of different ways. And so that we really need to resist it. But lately I've been starting to think that I don't just need to be against fascism. I need to be against violence.
Yeah.
That nonviolence is actually what Jesus calls us to. And if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, if you want to be a disciple of Christ, if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, his teaching is fairly clear there about nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And he says at the end of the Sermon on the Mount that the person that builds their house on the rock is the one who hears these words and actually puts them into practice. Yes. And later at the end of Matthew's gospel, when they go back to Galilee and he's talking to them there, he says, what I want are disciples who know how to obey the things that I have taught you. So it seems to me that what Jesus was wanting was kind of an alternative nonviolent kingdom that would be populated by his disciples as a sign in this world. And that basically since Christianity became involved in empire, that has been largely lost as a kind of central understanding. It was present in the early centuries of the church.
Yes.
But then it got lost. And even in mainline Protestantism was kind of the Christian group that was kind of the, I don't know, unofficial religious group that kind of carried the flag and supported America in war and, you know, World War I, World War II. But then I think in Vietnam, the mainline church sort of stepped back a little bit and said, wait a second, maybe we need to start questioning some of these things. But then the evangelical church stepped in and carried that role. But it's been very difficult for mainline Christianity and evangelical Christianity to seriously disentangle themselves from violence.
Yeah.
And somehow becoming clear about nonviolence. So if I'm going to oppose fascism as a disciple of Christ, then I must do it in a nonviolent way.
Yeah.
And being clear about nonviolence, sometimes just, I want peace, I want love. Somehow that sometimes doesn't equate to, well, sometimes in order to get peace and love, you got to kill a bunch of people. Well, not if you're following Jesus, that's not the way to do it. So could you talk a little bit about the importance of nonviolence as a commitment that a serious follower of Jesus, I think, needs to, I'm becoming persuaded that that's a commitment that I want to take more seriously and talk about more. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
There's a little saying that I can't remember who told it to me, but I just keep thinking about it. And here's the saying: means are ends in the making. We all know the saying, ends don't justify the means. I think there's a lot of truth to that. But means are ends in the making. I think this is what Jesus means when he says, if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. If you use violence so your side wins, you're creating a more violent world. You're achieving victory through violence. And so I think so central to Jesus' teaching is telling us, pay attention to the means. Not only no violent actions, but he says, look, you call your brother a blockhead or an idiot, which I've done, you know, many times. And he says, you know, that's you say, oh, I didn't commit murder. It's okay. But Jesus understood if you use violent words, you're preparing yourself to dehumanize somebody that makes it easier to then commit violent actions. And so, but what's so stunning to me about Jesus' approach, remember he goes to Jerusalem and he weeps and he says, Jerusalem, if only you knew what makes for peace. If only you knew what makes for peace. And he tells us, blessed are the peacemakers. So here's the problem. When people hear about nonviolence, or there are many problems, here's a problem. When people hear about nonviolence, they think, somebody's coming at you with a gun, do you use a weapon to protect yourself? That's not the point. The point is, how much effort do we expend in creating the conditions that make for peace? If we knew the things that make for peace, we would build a peaceful world. The goal is the kind of conditions we create, not just the rules of nonviolence. But it all starts with saying, I would like there to be a nonviolent world. I dream of, I pray for, I long for a nonviolent world. If that's the end that I want, then I want my means to contribute to that end. Mm-hmm. And that's another place where it would be so easy for us to just invite people to say, do you wish we could build a nonviolent world? Would you like a nonviolent world to exist? And people then say, oh, it's impossible, it'll never happen, because it'll only happen when Christ returns, which to me is just this horrible abuse of the Bible, and it's just crappy theology to make that kind of excuse. But I like to tell people, I'm old enough that when I was a boy, I remember seeing on TV quite often men slapping women. And people don't realize it wasn't that long ago where you would see on television men slapping women. And these weren't bad guys. These were the heroes of the story. And what has happened in my lifetime in this country is it's become unacceptable for men to slap women. It still happens, tragically, but it's everybody agrees it's bad. It's only a bad man that would do that. Things can change. It starts with a commitment and a desire for a more peaceful world.
Don, well, we're kind of, I don't know that we're exactly wrapping up, but I want to honor Brian's time. Do you have a question you'd like to ask?
I really appreciate all of what you're saying there, Brian. And I'm reminded again of some of the stuff and I think it's that same season with Gareth Higgins with the domination stories, yes, and the revolution stories and just how deeply I feel like that's embedded in the way people exercise power and if they're on the oppressed end of power, want to just oppress others, not even necessarily consciously want to, but that's how, yes, we just do this back and forth. But the Jesus narrative is this love your enemy narrative, we preach the love God and love your neighbor. But that love your enemy thing, man, that gets me every time. And I feel like in some ways, I think that has the seed of the gospel, just,
yes,
deeply buried in it. And then at the end of it all, you know, on the cross, he's saying, forgive them, they know not what they do. I have to keep reminding myself for my neighbors who I can't understand how they see the world the way they do or who they voted for or how they follow. I really don't think they know what they're doing. I keep trying to remind myself of that to not lose, to keep in touch with our shared humanity. And to, I mean, obviously there are things I don't know that I'm doing as well, but I do think that humility has to play a part in how we approach this if we ever hope to recover the world that we're called to.
Mm. Yeah. You know, Brian, you were talking, we've been talking some about stories too, and the way that we tell story. And often the Christian story is told with an incredibly violent ending where, yes, there's a great big war and then there's a hell and people are tortured in it forever. Yes. Or there's a heaven that maybe some will escape to if they have the right, if they follow Jesus the right way. And,
yes.
But there's another way of telling the Christian story, yes, which is the consummation of all creation and a joyful, yes, restoration of all things, which the entire human family is then brought, yes, together. And that forgiveness expands to and understanding expands through the, yes, whole human family. And we're all brought together. And, you know, you get hints of this, some pretty strong hints of this in the New Testament with Jesus. Just one of them would be, if I'm lifted up, I'll draw all people to myself. There's a lot of, yes, these statements that seem to suggest an ultimate restoration of some kind. So I was maybe wondering if you could talk about what are ways that we can tell maybe the Christian story that leads us to envision and to think of this future where there is this reconciliation and this joyful harmony. Because boy, if people can live towards that as the future story, yes, then they can embrace that in the present. And I think that could really tone down a lot of the violence that we see.
I couldn't agree with you more. Yes, ultimately, I don't think we have figured out what it really means to be Christians. You know, I heard a Quaker theologian say one time, a proper understanding of the incarnation and the identity of Christ is not to say we had this definition of God and Jesus came along and we lifted him up to that definition. This Quaker scholar said, no, we had all these definitions of God and Jesus came along and forced us to rethink our very understanding of God. And when Jesus comes as a nonviolent man who never killed anybody, who never threatened anybody with violence, he healed people. He didn't take life. He gave life. He taught the poor. He respected people that other people shamed and scapegoated. If Jesus was like that, he dared us to believe that God could be like that. And to me, it's an invitation I want to make to everybody, to everybody who identifies as a Christian, to say, why don't you take the next step and actually believe that Jesus helps us see the deepest heart of God, and that it's pure love, it's pure joy, it's pure peace, not hate, not resentment and anger, not hostility.
Yeah. Trip Fuller says just plainly, God is at least as nice and loving as Jesus. And I just think that
it's a great way to say
it. Yeah, it just sums it up.
Yeah, I've meditated on the First John that God is light in whom there is no God is love, God is light in whom there's no darkness at all. And so if that's the beginning of everything, light and love and love and light in whom there's no darkness at all, then if we can imagine that at the end somehow that light and love then permeate through the entire creation, and that finally the darkness is not going to win with anybody or in any way, then to me that really helps to hold on to that in that moment. I'm not really holding on to the hope. My hope isn't that we're going to get our political system straightened out. I have some kind of a hope that transcends the world. It informs the way that I live in this world in a nonviolent, loving kind of way, and maybe try to reduce harm. But I just think telling that story in such a way that people can envision and really. Not just as a whimsical kind of hope, but as kind of a resurrection hope that this is the story, this is the people that we are called to be.
And I think the hope that's empowering, Brian, you mentioned that, you know, people will say, well, that kind of peace isn't going to happen until Jesus comes. My theological position on that is Jesus is waiting to come through us. I mean, that we are the body of Christ. I think I read that somewhere. Yeah. And that I think this can be the empowering piece for us, that it is within our power to bring the love and life of Christ to bear on the world. That we have to do it together, and we can only do it in piecemeal fashion at times, but I have to do what I can do today to take the next step, to do the next right thing, and to tell a better story so that I live into a better world.
I would rather keep failing with that as my aspiration than succeed in anything else.
Amen.
Well, Brian, I think we're also enjoying your podcast, the Learning How to See podcast. I really enjoyed your recent episode, Seeing Nonviolently with Reverend John Deere.
Yes.
Thought that was very compelling. So tell us just kind of where you are with your Learning How to See podcast, and maybe what you think the future of that is, or where you are and what you're looking forward to now.
Yes. Well, the inspiration for that came from two sources. When I was very young, I was a singer, and I did an album, and my first album was called Learning How to Love. And so this idea that life is for learning, a quote from Joni Mitchell, and actually others have said that in different songs, but that life is for learning. And then when I started working at the Center for Action and Contemplation with Richard Rohr, Richard often defines contemplation as learning how to see, or learning how to meet all the reality we can bear. And so that shaped the design of this podcast. And in this year where there is so much tension and anxiety, because wherever authoritarians go, they spread fear and they spread division. And it seemed like the right theme for this year was to talk about learning how to see through eyes of love. And so that was our, we started off this, the spring season with some beautiful episodes with amazing people talking about times when they have seen through eyes of love, times they've been seen. And then in our fall season, we're going to look at many of our key relationships and just reflect on what it would mean to approach our spouses, our children, our parents, our siblings, our friends, our coworkers, animals and plants, the earth, and of course, God and ourselves through eyes of love. So that's the shape of this year. So I can't imagine what we'll do after this, because it doesn't seem like there's anything more important than that.
Well, Don, do you want to offer some words of thanks to Brian as we're closing up?
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned at the outset, I've been incredibly blessed and encouraged through your work over the last 2+ decades, and really appreciate the opportunity to be part of this conversation. We've had a couple of conversations at various events, the last one being a couple of years ago at Wild Goose. I doubt that you remember, but it meant a lot to me. I have a calling towards some economic justice as part of my ministry. Yes. Part of that being because I'm in the heart of Walmart land, and and you pointed me towards some resources and other authors that have been really helpful in that. So anyway, I just appreciate all that you do. And I know that you've been a help to pastors around the country for a long time. So thanks for all of that.
Oh, thanks. And can I just say what a joy it is to be with you both. And I'm so grateful for your work and your encouraging words, and that you took on this subject. It's important. And I mean, there are times where you don't want to say this sort of thing too glibly, but it could be that our conversation today will help save some lives and maybe help people get on a path of peace.
All right. Well, thank you for those closing words, Brian. We sure appreciate you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Grace Saves All. You can help spread the word by sharing this podcast with others and by giving it a rating on iTunes. If you want to find out more about David, or if you'd like to leave him a message, go to his website, davidartman.net. In the meantime, let's work together to help a hurting world know about the greatest news ever announced.